Welcome to the State of the Race. It is Friday, May 3rd, 2024, 186 days until the general election, 73 days until the Republican National Convention, and 108 days until the Democratic National Convention. Coming up on today's episode, Trump is spending the weekend with donors and potential VP picks in Florida. We'll tell you who is there. Biden is underperforming the polls versus 2020 in almost every demographic. We'll tell you the exceptions and how campus protests are putting Biden in an impossible position. But we start by doing the key metrics, and we lead here with the approval rate for Joe Biden. Is he improving his approval rate? Really, no. I mean, he's been flat at about 39% for a while, currently checking in at 38.9% approval, 55.7% disapproval. These numbers are outwardly terrible. Yet, if you go to the prediction markets, who will win the 2024 presidential election? Joe Biden still edges out Donald Trump, 51% to 47% chance of winning the election in November. What is the kind of our current place? Where are we standing right now? What is the state of the race right now? If the race were to be held today, where would we be? And let me just give you a rundown of the quick summary of the average polls in a bunch of the swing states and the national picture. And it's interesting to look at from a couple of different perspectives. The national rate right now, according to Real Clear Politics, we'll use their averages. National is at Trump plus 1.5%. I do feel like a lot of people, particularly in conservative media, feel right now that that lead is larger than that. It feels larger than that. Honestly, I think the Electoral College lines up to tell you a story that it is a little bit larger than that. However, a 1.5% lead for Trump is significant in multiple ways. Remember, he lost the popular vote in both 2016 and 2020. He can lose the popular vote and still win the election the way these states play out. And if he's winning the popular vote when it comes to the national picture, that doesn't mean anything, of course, when it comes to our electoral system, but it does tell us a story that Trump is in a much better position than he's been in either 2016 or 2020. This is true. I've been harping on this for, months. You know, a lot of times it feels like, oh, Donald Trump isn't doing so well. I think when you look at the mainstream media coverage, he is at his best place when it comes to polling, basically that he's ever been, going back to his, 2000 semi-run for president in the Reform Party. Like all the other runs, he's never really been in a position as good as this, certainly not for the extended period he's been in this position polling-wise. Let me run through a few of the swing states. We'll go through seven of them here, seven of the big ones. And they fall into two categories. One category where I think you'd say these states are currently leaning toward Donald Trump, and then one category where these states are basically full toss-ups. So let's start with the leaners here. Arizona, the average right now, Trump plus 5%. Remember, he lost Arizona in 2020. Nevada, Trump plus 4.5%. Again, he lost Nevada in 2020. These are nice big turnarounds. North Carolina, Trump plus 5.4%. Honestly, this is bubbling on the fact, on the borderline of whether it's even should be included as a swing state. Trump did win North Carolina and now has a 5.4% lead. And then Georgia, Trump, of course, lost in 2020, but he is up by 3.8% in the averages over at Real Clear Politics. So those are the ones you'd say maybe are leaning Trump right now. Then we have basically toss-up states. Now, the interesting thing about these toss-up states is Trump still leads in all of them. All of them. They're just very close in the margins. Wisconsin, Trump plus 1.8. Michigan, Trump plus 1.2%. And Pennsylvania, Trump plus 1%. Now, let me just boil this down. If you didn't want to hear all those numbers, let me give you a bottom line when it comes to all these key metrics today. If you were to take all these states, put everybody where we expect them to be, and give the Trump-leaning states to Donald Trump, and keep the toss-up states in the middle. So we'll keep them as question marks right now. If you put those into the map, what you get is Trump with 268 electoral votes and Joe Biden with 226 electoral votes. Obviously, Trump with a pretty large lead there. However, you might note not 270 electoral votes, which is what he needs to become president of the United States. To get across that line, he'd need to win one of those three swing states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Can he pull that off? Now, you might remember, he did not pull any of those three off in 2020, which is, you know, obviously what cost him the election. We will see if he's able to do that. And these things are going to change. Again, I would not lock anything in about polling this early, but it is interesting to look at and kind of give you a place to kind of, you know, a little point on the map here. What is the state of the race on a day like May 3rd? That's what it looks like today. It's about 6 months to go, though, so plenty of time. Let me look at the quick candidate updates for you. Trump is going to be, he's, you know, transitioning from attending a trial in New York, or of course he's got the 34 felony counts, which is basically just one count, but 34 felony counts relating to falsifying business records. He's going to Florida. He's going to have the Republican National Committee's spring donor retreat that goes on. A lot of big donors going to be there. Major GOP donors. They're going to have discussions at the Four Seasons Hotel and, of course, Mar-a-Lago as well. Trump plans to announce his running mate. They are reporting that it's probably going to be closer to the Republican National Convention, as I mentioned. That is in July, about 73 days away. It's July 15th. There are six potential VP candidates that are attending this. Now, it's interesting. If you're going to name a new vice president, do you invite that new vice president to an event like this? You'd think the answer to that would definitely be yes, right? Like, you wouldn't, if you were really considering somebody for VP, why wouldn't you invite them to an event with their biggest donors? You want that VP to be able to do the type of underling work that a VP needs to do during a campaign, which a lot of times is meeting with big time donors and getting more of their money. And so you'd think you'd want that person in the room. That doesn't mean that you would. Of course, there are always surprises. There are, you know, maybe he just doesn't want to tip his hand as to who he's picking. But the six people who are there, let me give them to you in reverse order of I think, a power ranking right now. We'll power rank these six VP candidates where I think they are right now. Do I know anything? I don't have any inside reporting particularly on this, but I will say here's what I think they are. Sixth place, Kristi Noem. Now, I would have put Kristi Noem higher after the before the past week or so. She's really struggling, not only with the dog death story, but also some other facts in her book. She has not necessarily had a great response to it. She's doing what she can. She's going into damage control mode. You read the excerpts from the book. Man, it sounds like somebody who thinks she's going to be VP. She's someone who's at least pitching for that job. But, you know, I don't know. It just seems like Donald Trump does not need additional headaches. And Kristi Noem, at this point, seems like she might provide some. So I'm putting her in sixth. Fifth place, Doug Burgum of North Dakota. There's a lot of reporting that Doug Burgum is a serious candidate for this role. You remember Burgum from, unless you live in North Dakota, you probably only remember him from a debate or two back in the day. Never really made much of an impact, 1 or 2%, kind of bought his way into the debates in the first place. He's a very wealthy guy. Of course, that's something Trump respects. He sees someone who's successful in business. He does have a pretty good record as governor. There are some policy positions you might not agree with. We can go through those if this becomes more serious. But generally speaking, he's had a pretty good record as governor of North Dakota. And he's talked about pretty seriously. I don't see it. You know, Mike Pence was a quiet guy, a Christian guy, kind of helped with evangelical voters at a time where that was desperately needed from the Trump campaign. He checked the boxes. And, you know, he's a guy who you could see in that role. Burgum, I don't know. I mean, if anything, you think of him as almost like a Commerce Department type candidate. And that's why I said almost said secretary there, because he strikes me as cabinet secretary material. I don't know. Doug Burgum, not exciting. Now, Trump picked Pence, who is also not exactly the most electric guy. There is sort of two profiles here to go with. You either have the guy who's going to be quiet, calm, back you up, but not cause problems, and not really stand out. That's the Burgum profile, right? There's another profile there, and I think, you know, we'll get into a couple of those candidates here in a second, where it's more of the attack dog. You go on media, you're fighting it out. Now, Trump has not picked those people to fit those high roles. He's typically had those people as underlings to go on the media and fight it out on Sunday shows. He's got plenty of those people. but he's not typically put them in roles like this. We'll see if that happens. Tim Scott is a fourth place. He's going to be there as well. Scott is, you know, again, a guy I think who looks good on paper. He can raise money. We know that. Obviously, there is the identity politics element here where he happens to be an African-American candidate. I just don't think he campaigned all that well. I think he does better on paper than he does in real life. And I like Tim Scott, but it seems like the type of person that Trump would look at a lot of his stuff is with his gut. We see this over and over again in reporting. Anyone who knows him knows that he does a lot of this stuff with his gut. Tim Scott, while I think he's been a decent senator, he's I think a good guy, he comes off a little cringy at times. And he's had a lot of those moments during the campaign, despite a real wide runway for him to succeed. The media was in some ways cheering that on. The Republican sort of establishment was cheering it on for a while. It was never able to break through with voters. And I think Trump will see that as a real weakness. Third place, I'm going to put Elise Stefanik of New York. This is an interesting one. I mean, she's not very well known. And she is, of course, in upper echelons of the House for Republicans. She has been very, very impressive when it comes to the fallout of October 7th and the protests with these universities. Right now, that is the biggest story. And so she's really been able to shine through this. She's been very tough on this. She's basically responsible for getting multiple Ivy League style leaders out of their jobs. And she really did a good job in those hearings. It'll be interesting to see if Trump looks at this. I don't know if this issue necessarily is the big issue as we get closer to the election. But she's shown she can be an attack dog. She can be one of those people who knows what she's talking about, doesn't look like a wild-eyed maniac, but is able to kind of surgically go through and dismantle an opponent. And that is something that Trump respects. There's also the identity politics angle. I keep bringing that up because it is interesting as we go to the top of this list. But you got a female candidate there, of course, as well. Something that, you know, may be appealing, certainly for... If you look at the weakness, when Trump picked in Pence in 2016, his weakness was seen as evangelical voters. His weakness right now is seen as suburban women. And is this something that Elise Stefanik can agree with? I don't know. I mean, I will say a lot of women that I talk to don't particularly love female politicians. They don't fall in love with them as the way that the pollsters would tell you they might. We will see how that works out. Second place, I have Marco Rubio of Florida. This one also has had some reporting behind it. I don't know how seriously to take it. I do feel like the fact that Trump's demeaned him a lot in the past, you know, he likes having those stories where he's won people over, where he, you know, Rubio hated him and now is seemingly loving him. There's a lot of disagreement here. And Rubio is a formidable candidate. He can raise money for you. Again, identity politics. He has, he's obviously of Cuban descent. So there is potentially something there. They both do live in Florida. You'd have to fix that. That can be fixed very easily. Normally, and this happened with Cheney and Bush. Cheney had to move out back to Wyoming for that particular situation. You can't have two president and vice president from the same state. That's just a restriction of the office. But that is another possibility. And number one I have is J.D. Vance of Ohio. And look, Vance is, a photogenic guy. He can go on media and has no problem debating. He's a fire breather. He can do that. He can do it in a relatively intellectual way. He is capable of defending Trump's policies. If you were to point out who is the actual, like Marco Rubio does not believe in Trump's policies line by line. Tim Scott does not believe in those policies line by line. Doug Burgum does not believe in those policies line by line. J.D. Vance is about as close as you can get to someone who's put an ideology to what we kind of refer to generally as Trumpism, which largely reflects Trump's opinions, right? Like Trump's general personal vibes about an issue at any particular moment. They're not always, as we know, ideologically consistent in every way. There have been efforts, certainly multiple think tanks have attempted this, to kind of put an intellectual and ideological scaffolding on what Trump seems to believe, this sort of populist new right situation. It's not always been successful, and most other candidates who have attempted it have not been successful with it. But Trump has been, certainly in 2016 and through the primaries. So J.D. Vance, I think, actually could be the next generation of what we're calling maybe Trumpism. He has a lot of those same beliefs and is, you know, he knows how to do TV. He, you know, has the central casting thing that goes on. Almost everybody on this list outside of Burgum does. You wonder if J.D. Vance would be the pick if identity politics were removed from it. And of course, we talk about Trump as someone who doesn't care about these things. Yet every piece of reporting constantly says, hey, well, he's going to pick a woman. He's going to pick someone, person of color. I don't know. Maybe he'll pick that. There's a lot of qualified people out there that fit that description. But J.D. Vance seems to be really a strong fit. You know, he's in a region. Well, Ohio is really a more right-leaning state. I mentioned the three states that Trump needs to win one of the three states to win in this particular election if these polls hold up the way they are. And right now, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, somebody from Ohio kind of fits that mold. You have some similarities in the region. You have a lot of the same concerns on these states. Obviously, Pennsylvania and Ohio, very closely linked. So bottom line is I have J.D. Vance number one. We will see what happens with that. And let's go finally into, I'm going too long here, but I know normally I try to keep these things short, but it's been a while since we've done a new episode. I want to give you an analysis from the Brookings Institution as we go into today's focus. And this is interesting when it comes down to whether President Trump can hold off President Biden and what is the difference between the margins of 2020 to 2024. And what we see here is a national perspective where Biden is down 5 points nationally, down 4 points with men and 8 points with women. Remember, Trump performed very badly with suburban women in 2020. This is what cost him the election. A lot of people talked about what happened, you know, in inner cities and all of that. And you can look at all that stuff all you want, but the difference in the actual election came from counties bordering those cities largely. Typically female voters falling away. So a very good sign there for Trump if that holds. White voters have gone toward Donald Trump by 2 points. Black voters have gone to Trump by 25 points. We've spent a lot of time talking about minority voters, and it's really a key issue here as we go forward. Hispanic voters have gone toward Donald Trump by 13 points. Asian voters by 21 points. He's performing very well among these voters. Even college-educated voters. We talk often, and we hear the media break down these numbers often and say, well, Trump is just doing very well with his working-class voters that didn't go to college. But, Biden is going to win those voters. Well, he probably will win those voters. He won them by 15 points in 2020. However, he's only up by 10 right now. A 5-point movement toward Donald Trump. We see movement toward Donald Trump in almost every demographic, including younger voters and elderly voters. Younger voters have moved toward Donald Trump by 3 points. Biden won them, of course, in 2020 by 24 points. He now leads by 21. Elderly voters, different, totally different scale, but still same thing. They've moved toward Donald Trump by 3 points. Trump won them by 4 points. Back in 2020, he's winning them by 7 points today. But the biggest movement is among voters 30 to 49 years old, where Donald Trump lost these voters by 12 points back in 2020, 55 to 43. He now leads them by two. This is a 14-point switch among that particular demographic. Everything else has moved a little bit, but that particular group, 30 to 49-year-old voters, have moved massively toward Donald Trump. You can see these voters as the types that are thinking to themselves, hey, I'm going in and I am looking at a world where with an economy that was pretty good as I was going up in my 20s. Now here I am in my 30s, maybe into my early 40s, my prime earning years, and this economy doesn't look so good. So that's where we've seen the most movement. There's only one demographic in this entire study that shows movement toward Joe Biden. And it's hilarious because it's Trump's base. Back in 2020, we've seen a massive lead for Donald Trump among white voters that were not college educated. This is the strength of his coalition. In fact, he won it by a margin of 65 to 33, a 32-point margin. Now, it hasn't had much movement back toward Joe Biden, only a 3-point movement. So now It's a 29-point lead instead of a 32-point lead. However, this is one of the biggest groups of voters that we see in the entire electorate. But again, I'm not trying to paint you this as a positive story for Joe Biden. This is a disaster. Every single group, over and over and over again, you see massive fall off from 2020. And he doesn't have much interest in seemingly addressing a lot of these middle-of-the-road voters. He may have tried to do that in this speech this week when it comes to the college protesters. He looked at this situation and said, hey, maybe I need to make a statement. Everyone's pressuring me to make a statement. He came out and made one. I was not impressed by it. However, it did seem to annoy some people on the far left. And you think about the calculus here. This is an impossible position for Biden when it comes to just politics. Now, of course, the thing you should do is come out and say what you believe and come by a set of principles and stick by them. That's not, of course, how Joe Biden operates. So how did he come to the decision to say, hey, yeah, free speech is important, but you got to follow the law. We can't be having this harassment of Jewish students and all these things. Or if you had to say he leaned one way, it was maybe a little bit more toward what the middle would like. Well, why did he do that? Well, polling has come out showing what people believe about these college protests. Let me just give you a quick rundown of this. Should we ask the police to protect campuses from violence? Well, of course, the far left would say no to that. But what is that number? Well, it's 76% of voters say, yeah, bring them in. 76 to 10 is the margin on that. Should we offer resources to help students understand the conflict? Yeah, yes, 68 to 15. In other words, people don't know what they're talking about. These students don't know the story. Should we provide mental health resources and sensitivity training to help students navigate conversations? And a lot of these are just BS. That's 65 to 16. Should we ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations on campuses? This is a pretty wide ranging. This is a broad restriction. That's still supported, 47 to 30. In fact, even Democrats favor it, 41 to 36. Banning pro-Palestinian protests. Think of what the media talks to you about questions like this totally differently. Should you make statements condemning Hamas's actions against Israel? Yes, overwhelming support. 17 points in support of that particular phrase. Should we ban pro-Israeli demonstrations on campuses? That one's split as well, about 50-50. Or it's 41-37. Technically, there's a big chunk in the middle that don't have an opinion on that. By the way, you shouldn't be banning protests, but it's the illegal activity associated to these protests that is the problem. Should you divert university investments away from Israeli companies? Again, that is just 38% support that notion. Most people don't have much of an opinion on it. And finally, should you make statements condemning Israel's actions in Gaza? 33% support, 42% do not support that particular notion. Again, you feel like when you look at the media, everybody's talking about, well, this is the pro-Palestinian protests, and wow, how can the right wing be cracking down on these poor people? Well, that's not how the American people seem to see it. They seem to see it as, yeah, you should absolutely stop these things, and police should be involved stopping them. And when asked about whether they support Israel or Hamas, the numbers are quite clear. We'll have more as these go on, as we get a little bit later in the election process. I may have another episode next week, but we're going to start getting into the summer pretty soon. And summer is convention season. So we're going to be on election watch for you constantly here in the next few months. Be sure to share this podcast and subscribe to it. If you don't already, 5-star review would, of course, be appreciated. Thanks so much. And we will see you next time on State of the Race.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser Bestes.